Once upon a time, a bowl of leeches cured us of our every ill. No such thing as the uninsured. The poultry paid our doctor bills. Sicknesses were all the same. Progress, man. Simplicity's bane. Progress, man. Modifying some moldy cave. Break off a big stalactite. Club a girl and take her home to breed a little tribe of troglodytes. In the good old days, we were all nomads and everybody knew you either hunted or died. Thinking man is crazy when we started to farm, and now we run a charity that serves worldwide. It's all truistic entropy. Progress, well, it isn't for me. Progress, man, I wanna go back. Progress, yeah, it's gotta be stopped. Progress, man.
Well, I hope they build a time machine, 'cause a different age would suit me well. Send me back 4 billion years when everyone was single-celled.
And yes, indeedy, all us single-celled beings are gathered here by the tens of thousands for this Monday, July 7, 2014 edition of Mideast Migraines. This is the show where your favorite friendly local Palestinian American here in Santa Cruz County, California, dispenses truth and justice in his own inimical way. I just love saying inimical. This program is being recorded, and within a matter of a week or so, will be available at another website, radioforall.net. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, the numerical character 4, A-L-L.N-E-T, radioforall.net. They need your money too, by the way. They have disk drives that wear out and equipment that needs replacement and maintenance. Lots of interesting things at radioforall.net. Previous episodes, of course, of Mideast Migraines and the formerly Mideast Madness program are available there, including readings from the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, which comes to you at 11 a.m. every Saturday, 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. All Saturday editions are dedicated to the reading of books about Israelis, Palestinians, Arabs, and the like. That topic area there. And, ooh, that's awfully loud. I don't think I need to have it turned up. Okay, just loud enough for me to know that I'm on the air. My name is Ren Tawil, your favorite local Palestinian American. Let me go ahead and give out the phone numbers. Area code 831. One phone line, anyway, 831-427-3772. Again, area 831-427-3772. If you like, you can also send a message to this program's email address, which is MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness. At G is in gargantuan, M is in malevolent, X as in xenophobe, .com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Not too long ago, I began turning my attention to the concept of slightly broadening the topic areas for discussion, my discussion, assuming no one else calls in to have a discussion with me, outside of the Middle East conflict, the older traditional one of Arab versus Jew, Jew versus Muslim and Christian, etc., Palestinians versus Israel, and I occasionally talk about the other things. Well, I sometimes read dispatches from the United Nations News Center, including a lot that have nothing to do with the Middle East, little or nothing to do with it. I like to talk about passenger train service in the United States, and I read dispatches from the National Association of Railroad Passengers, stuff like that. The Midwest High-Speed Rail Association, maybe. But I'm really anxious to begin looking more into the general topic of disinformation, the dispensation of disinformation, the deliberate attempt to misguide people away from what's really happening out there, and trying to get a handle as best we can on that. Believe you me, it ain't easy. But, and in particular, especially until I get more people to call in to the program and take me up on some of this stuff, and until and when, after I begin receiving more messages at the MideastMadness@gmx.com email address, I'm pretty much just going to stick with Palestinians and Israelis, with Palestine and Israel. I don't want to bore people to death. I suppose that's my main motivation for not only talking about this stuff. I like to take a break. There, of course, are the musical selections that I choose, including Stuart Davis of Minnesota. Masterful and genius lyricist and musician that he is. His voice ain't too bad either, but he is getting old. I think he's in his late 30s now. My God. Okay. This, again, this is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, July 7, 2014. It's 3:10 p.m. And if that matches with your own personal time-space continuum, you know that the show is live and you may call in at any time. Don't worry about interrupting anything. Don't forget, if you happen to tune in to last Saturday's, 2 days ago, program, where I spent three-quarters of the show reading from They Dare to Speak Out, subtitled People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. I do not take calls during the reading of the book, so if you wanted to say something about that now, by all means, feel free to call in. Also, if you have anything to say about Gil Stein, give us a call. If you are Gil Stein, give us a call. Area code 831-427-3772. And I will be dropping what I'm doing. Although I'm alone here in the studio and sometimes have to juggle things, if the phone rings, I'll answer it. Honest to God. I have to notice it, of course. The ringers are on. I just hear. Let me triple check. Yes, I'll be able to hear the phone in addition to watching the lights flicker on the board. Okay, this piece here is written by, was written by Nir Hasson. And I only wish, shoot, I forget where this appeared. Maybe I never knew to begin with. But Nir Hasson wrote this article, 1,000 Rally Against Anti-Arab Violence Amid Calls for Revenge of Israeli Teen's Death. Okay, Jerusalem demonstration takes place at square where Jewish mob attacked Palestinian teens, more than one, Palestinian teens one day earlier, by Nir Hasson, July 2. And for those who speak, read, or otherwise understand Hebrew, there is a picture of a woman, apparently an Israeli woman there in Jerusalem, holding up a sign in Hebrew, which reads, "The people demand consolation," and is a play on the rhyming words for consolation and revenge in Hebrew, Nehama and Nekama. Just thought I'd point that out to you. Oh, actually, okay, this was sent to me by... appears to have two authors. Immediately under the title of the article, 1,000 Rally Against Anti-Arab Violence Amid Calls for Revenge of Israeli Teen's Death, it says Nir Hasson, but I believe he just passed it along. Now it says that the article was written or otherwise provided by Zev Sternhell, or Zev Sternhell, July 4th. That would have been last Friday, of course. About 1,000 demonstrators protested anti-Arab racism and violence in a rally on Wednesday in the aftermath of the murder of three kidnapped Israeli teens. The rally took place at a square in central Jerusalem where three Palestinian youths, count them, one, two, three, were attacked by a Jewish mob the night before and was attended by, among others, opposition leader, member of the Knesset, that's Israel's parliament, Isaac Herzog, Labor Party, M.K. Nitzan Horowitz, Meretz, the Meretz Party, and Rabbi Benny Lau. Jews and Arabs will have to live in this land forever, and that's why we have to repel together any attempt to harm our fragile relationship, Herzog said. That, of course, being a member of Parliament, member of Parliament Isaac Herzog of the Labor Party. He went on to say, "The extremists on both sides are trying to drag us all into a circle of blood. But most of the Jewish and American societies, I'm sorry, but most of the Jewish and Arab societies disagree and want to live in peace." On Tuesday night, hundreds of right-wing extremists took to the streets of Jerusalem, shouting racist slogans and calling for revenge against Arabs. In one case, a mob of 100 Jews attacked three Palestinians, one of whom was evacuated to a hospital for a head wound. Undercover police, who were there, quickly intervened, moved the attackers back, and arrested three of them. Overall, police arrested 50 Jews for involvement in the riots. Wednesday morning, the body of a Palestinian boy was found in a forest outside Jerusalem. And though police are still investigating, concerns were raised that the boy was murdered as an act of revenge for the three kidnapped Israelis. In Wednesday's rally, Rabbi Lau addressed the murderer and said, "I would like to learn the name of the murdered Arab, the same way we memorize the names of Eyal, Gilad, and Naphtali and their mothers. A Jew doesn't avenge. That isn't our language. We're educated to restrain power. Our whole DNA is like that. We're all so proud of it, and then suddenly you find yourself awash in racism and violence." End quote. The rally came against the background of calls for attacks on Palestinians made by tens of thousands of Israelis in a new Facebook group opened after the three teens' bodies were found. The online group has since been condemned by various Israeli politicians, including Justice Minister Tzipi Livni, who promised to prosecute those involved. And that, of course, would be those involved in the creation and maintenance of the Facebook account, which calls for revenge for the three murdered Israeli youths. And I'm trying to pull up that Facebook page, presuming it still exists, presuming I can. Golly, must be very busy. It took some time. Well, actually, it goes directly to the article in Haaretz, the premier Israeli news periodical. Haaretz, Tuesday, July 8, says here, come on, you little sucker, come on. says Israelis launch Facebook campaign calling for, quote, revenge of teens murderers. And you are taking your time, aren't you? I already read this particular article. I guess I was hoping to get right to the Facebook page. Well, it won't be terribly hard, but I don't want to take up any more time to do that, as it's really not necessary. On Saturday's show, which, as I mentioned, is usually dedicated wholly to the reading of whichever book we were engaged in at the time, I spent the first 30-35 minutes talking about the deaths of the three Israelis, the youths, and the killing of the one Palestinian boy and the attack of the other two. Along those lines, I really need to address the other side of the issue. From Palestinian Diary, when will this insanity end? This is presented by Mazin Kumsieh, who runs a popular pro-Palestine blog. Mazin Kumsieh is, of course, Palestinian, a professor. And here is, this is taken from his June 30 blog. A sadly familiar scene over the past 2 weeks here in occupied Palestine. 10 Palestinians, including a 7 and 15-year-old, and 3 Israeli settlers, 16 to 19 years old, were killed. I say again, 10 Palestinians, including a 7 and 15-year-old, and 3 Israeli settlers, 16 to 19-year-old, referring, of course, to the famous 3 who were brutally murdered, were killed. Dozens of Palestinian homes were demolished in the past 2 weeks. Dozens. Over 570 more Palestinians were kidnapped in these 2 weeks, making more than 6,000 abductees languishing in Israeli gulags and prisons. I'll break in here and clarify, of course, obviously, Mr. Kumsieh, when he says Palestinians kidnapped, he refers overwhelmingly to those who were taken into custody by the Israeli so-called defense forces, or perhaps other security police forces. Although that often happens with little or no explanation, spoken explanation anyway, against Palestinians, be they adults or youths. So he lops them together as kidnapped. Over 570 more Palestinians kidnapped in these 2 weeks, etc. He goes on to say 15,000 Palestinian homes invaded without due process. I say again, 1,500. 1,500 Palestinian homes invaded without due process. 12 million native Palestinians still await their freedom from colonial occupation and displacement. And by that, of course, he means following the 400-year Turkish-Ottoman imperial occupation of Palestine, of the Fertile Crescent there, and then Great Britain's occupation lasting some 28 years, or longer, actually, dating back to World War I, and then what he considers to be ongoing foreign Israeli imperialist colonization and occupation. 12 million native Palestinians still await their freedom from colonial occupation and displacement. And Israeli leaders are promising to, quote, do more, in parentheses here, genocidal mayhem, question mark. But the question remains, when will this insanity end? Can it end by negotiations between occupied and occupier? Negotiations that have been going on for 22 years, while Israel gets $12 billion profit every year from its occupation. And he points out here, that is not counting the billions from U.S. taxpayers. When will Israel be led by people like the previous speaker of the Israeli Knesset, Avraham Berg, instead of racists like Netanyahu? Listen to the wise words of Berg. Quote, "Here are Israel's shallow prime minister and the bumbling police, the masses who cling to futile prayers, and not to a moment of human peace. Here are the country's hypocritical chief rabbis, who just a month ago demanded promises from the Pope, the Catholic Pope, regarding the future of the Jewish people, but in their daily lives remain silent about the fate of the people, who are our neighbors, trampled beneath the pressure of occupation and racism." This is Avraham Berg talking, a previous speaker of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. "Trampled beneath the pressure of occupation and racism under the leadership of rabbis who receive exorbitant salaries and benefits. ... Despite the enormous and inspiring success of Breaking the Silence, which is an NGO, non-governmental organization, that collects testimony from soldiers who've served in the West Bank, Breaking the Silence, our own total silence is still the loudest thing around us. We're willing to go out of our minds over one odd and troublesome Pollard," referring to Jonathan Pollard, who was arrested a long time ago, many years ago, and convicted and currently serves time in an American prison for spying on the United States on behalf of Israel. "We are willing to go out of our minds over one odd and troublesome Pollard, a lone kidnap victim or three kidnap victims, but we are incapable of understanding the suffering of a whole society, its cry, and the future of an entire nation that has been kidnapped by us," referring, of course, to Palestine and Palestinians. "This, too, needs to be said and heard during this moment of clarity, and as loudly as possible," end quote. The Palestinians, a kidnapped society. "We are incapable of understanding the suffering of a society, its cry, and the future of an entire nation that has been kidnapped by us." By Avraham Berg. Okay, just as it looked, that appears to be a book entitled The Palestinians, a Kidnapped Society, by Avraham Berg, with a link here at Haaretz.com. Mr. Kumsier's blog goes on. "And how about the inspiring and wise words of Catholic Patriarch Michel Sabah writing from Jerusalem, congratulating Muslims on the start of Ramadan? Quote, we are all sectarian, Christians or Muslims. We all need to continuously purify the faith in us to overcome the sectarian. The believer is one who remembers God and sees all his creation, so he worships God and respects all his creation, no matter any religion they are. He sees any other as a brother or sister. The sectarian has strife in him and is distant from God. He sees only himself or his family or his clan. I hope that we all become believers and our faith overcomes all sectarian tendency," end quote. "I am reminded of the good-spirited picture someone shared on Facebook, a family where the father carries a sign that said, I am Sunni, the mother a sign that said, I am Shia, and the little girl carries a sign, I am Sushi." Sushi, you know, S-U-S-H-I. "In another video, I noted fraternizing between members of the Syrian army and the opposing Free Syrian army. That reminded me of 1914 when opposing German and British soldiers disobeyed orders of their commanders in World War I and decided to get together on Christmas and become friends. see www.eyewitnesstohistory.com/trenches.htm. The warmongers do not stop unless the people stop them. But at this moment is when I see candles of light in this darkness being lit everywhere. Palestinians and Israelis working together to achieve peace. For example, Israeli and Palestinian Association of Bereaved Families. A small group of activists, including Jewish Voice for Peace and Palestinian Americans, recently managed to outmaneuver the well-funded movement that hijacked U.S. policy. These good people managed to get the Presbyterians to divest holding in three companies that profit from the Israeli occupation. The whole world is getting tired of this apartheid and is starting to shake off the intimidation. Netanyahu, this of course refers to Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, can only kill more people, can only create more false flag operations. He has decided to speed up the Judaizing of Jerusalem and removal of its native people, which is to say Palestinian Arabs, who are non-Jewish. He can work for what he calls, quote, Kurdish independence. The U.S. and Israeli governments can continue to try and fund sectarianism and create divisions. They pursue the silly and dangerous notion that creating other sectarian states will finally give legitimacy to the, quote, Jewish state and its systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestine. They produce few, quote-unquote, successes, like strengthening the Mujahideen to remove the Soviets from Afghanistan or strengthening the, quote, Sunni Mujahideen to fight the Iran Shia boogeyman. But beware the monsters you create and instead try to create the peace that will be only based on justice. And beware of the sophistication and power of people who are increasingly not buying all your propaganda. Peace in Jerusalem equals peace on earth. Ramadan Kareem to our Muslim brothers and sisters, and to all, stay human. Mazin Kumsiye, Bethlehem, occupied Palestine. Please forward this article to everyone you know. There's a quotation here. We Palestinians are just like the flowers that I see now from my window. No matter how in the cold and harsh winter they are broken, no matter how in the hot summer they are burned and dried, no matter where in the autumn wind they are scattered, a day comes when they bloom again, fresh, young, and so beautiful. Anon. Alas, it is not attributed to anyone in particular. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. Streaming live at freakradio.org. Scroll down the main page, click on the red oval you see there for the free streaming link. It is 3:31 in the afternoon, Monday, July 7. Just grabbing a cold brew here. The brew being Diet Coke. May as well be preemptive here, make a preemptive strike against my aching throat. Not the most agreeable taste in the world, but that throat spray does something to my taste buds. Something good. What else do we have here? Even if you're glued to your TV sets and commercial radio sets, only for the mainstream evening news and national public radio, it's obvious that something hot and terrible and potentially even more threatening is brewing in Palestine and Israel, Jerusalem, the West Bank, the occupied territories. Yeah, I already read that one 2 days ago. How about this? Israel must be held accountable for its collective punishment of Palestinians. From the Palestinian BDS National Committee, BDS, of course, referring to the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement against Israeli cultural and academic institutions, and directed against certain American corporations and multinational corporations which profit from Israel's illegal, ongoing, and brutal occupation of land which it stole from the Palestinian Arabs. Israel must be held accountable for its collective punishment of Palestinians. From the BDSmovement.net website. Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions. BDS activists are urging governments and international civil society to take action to hold Israel to account for its continued collective punishment of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, the Gaza Strip, following the disappearance and death of three Israeli settlers. Saeed Shubai, a spokesperson for the Palestinian BDS National Committee, the civil society coalition that leads and supports the BDS movement, said Israel's ongoing actions are designed to terrorize Palestinians and constitute collective punishment. Military violence, collective punishment, and the deliberate targeting of civilians are endemic to Israel's decades-old system of occupation, colonization, and apartheid. Get down there. Quote, Zaid Shubai continues to speak here. Israel is able to act with utter impunity because of the military, economic, and political support it receives from governments around the world. We call on international governments to impose a two-way arms embargo immediately and to suspend bilateral agreements until Israel fully complies with international law. At a time when mainstream bodies such as the Bill Gates Foundation, the Presbyterian Church USA, and the U.S. United Methodist Church are divesting from companies profiting from Israel's occupation, including G4S and Hewlett-Packard, we call on people of conscience to intensify BDS pressure, end quote. Shubai also called on people of conscience and supporters of BDS to consider joining the Month Against the Apartheid Wall that is marking the 10th anniversary of the International Court of Justice ruling that Israel's apartheid wall is illegal. Hundreds of military raids have been launched across... Listen up, folks. Hundreds of military raids have been launched across the occupied West Bank from Israel since June 12, less than a month ago, with more than 1,000 private homes and refugee camps in the offices of civil society organizations ransacked. At least 10 Palestinians have been killed and many more have been injured. More than 500 Palestinians have been detained, and initial reports suggest that many of those arrested are held under administrative detention, a form of detention without charge or trial, on secret evidence. That's what it says here, on secret evidence. The number of children held in Israeli jails has risen to 250. And yes, child categorically includes those up through age 17. Continuing, Israel has also imposed severe restrictions of movement. On Wednesday, Israeli settlers kidnapped and killed a 16-year-old from the Shuafat area of Palestinian East Jerusalem, and Israeli soldiers attacked Palestinians in Jerusalem. Palestinian organizations have detailed how Israel's recent actions constitute collective punishment, a crime prohibited by the Fourth Geneva Convention, as well as customary international humanitarian law. Israeli occupation forces, the so-called IDF, have also targeted the campuses of Birzeit University near Ramallah and the Arab American University in Jenin, resulting in the detention and arrest of students and staff and greatly infringing the Palestinian right to education. Samia Botme, a professor at Birzeit University and a steering committee member with the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, said the following, quote, "Israel's latest violations against Palestinian universities are part of its long history of oppression aimed at Palestinian education. Closure of universities for periods stretching to years, murder and detention of students and professors, destruction of universities' properties and laboratories, as well as the banning of lists of books, have been Israel's systematic policies targeting Palestinian education." Samia went on to say, "It must be emphasized that throughout the decades of oppression, no Israeli university or association of Israeli academics has ever protested the sustained assaults on Palestinian universities." And I might add, it's the greatest likelihood is that no Israeli university or association of Israeli academics has ever experienced such invasion, oppression, ransacking, and intimidation. Only the Palestinian institutions of those. Okay. As the statement goes on here, "It is essential to intensify all forms of BDS, including the academic and cultural boycott, until Israel ends its violations of Palestinian rights," end quote. Israel has conducted at least 100 airstrikes and shellings of Gaza in recent days, including an intense bombing of dozens of locations in the early hours of Tuesday, further worsening the situation for Palestinians in Gaza, which has been under a brutal military siege for more than 7 years. And a reminder, this article is dated July 4th from the Palestinian BDS National Committee, bdsmovement.net. Goes on to say here, Haidar Ayn, associate professor at Al-Aqsa University in Gaza and a PACB, PACBI, steering committee member said, quote, "We, residents of Gaza, have been unable to fathom how it is that official bodies of the international community tolerate blatant war crimes committed against the people of Gaza, in spite of thousands of reports by mainstream human rights organizations. Is it far-fetched to expect people of conscience to heed our call to boycott this intransigent, racist, and militarized Israeli regime and the institutions that keep it thriving the same way apartheid South Africa was boycotted until it crumbled?" End of quotation. Aya Abu Bashir, a youth and BDS activist in Gaza, added, quote, "During the past few weeks, Israel has been violently and intensely launching a series of airstrikes against the Gaza Strip. The population of the Gaza Strip continues to pay the price and bear the blaze of Israel's policies. Because collective punishment is a war crime under the Geneva Conventions, we urge the international community to pressure Israel to end its all-out military assault aimed against the total population of Gaza, open Rafah crossing permanently, and heed our calls for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, end quote. End of article, end of statement. Israel must be held accountable for its collective punishment of Palestinians from the Palestinian BDS National Committee. Incidentally, the aforementioned Rafah crossing is the major transborder crossing between the Gaza Strip, which is not part of Israel, although it is effectively controlled by Israel since the Israeli army controls access to and from it at all other crossings and all sea and air access as well, although the Rafah crossing goes between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. The Egyptian government, in whatever form that currently is, still maintains a tenuous agreement with Israel, which is really based on the old Mubarak regime's fear and suppression of the Islamic Brotherhood, which is essentially the Egyptian political version of Hamas, which is the Egyptian Brotherhood in control, political control of the Gaza Strip Palestinians. Egypt is in this tenuous agreement with Israel to on again, off again, open or close the Rafah crossing based on God knows what, whatever the current policy or the current thinking is. Okay, my friends, it's about a quarter to four here in the afternoon Pacific time. I'm going to, the phone number here is area code 831-427-3772. Oh, boy, that's nice. Just, as I said earlier, I'm here in the studio alone. And so I must jump from task to task and occasionally perform certain functions here, administrative functions and technical things here. Okay, put that aside for now. But I'm going to, phone number here again, area code 831-427-3772. That's 831-427-3772. Line number one to the studio, where you will go right onto the air, is 427-3772. Continuing right along this vein of subject here, condemn Israel's escalation of violence. This statement from the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, or IJAN. International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. Protest Israel's escalation of violence. They too speak up. The International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, IJAN, condemns Israel's escalation of violence, as well as the revenge threats by the Israeli government and citizens and Zionist organizations and public figures. We denounce Western states and media claiming this brutality is somehow justified retribution for the deaths of three Jewish settlers from the racist Jewish-only colony of Gush Etzion in the West Bank of Palestine. In the space of just a few days, the Gaza Strip has been indiscriminately bombarded by warplanes. Upwards of 600 Palestinians have been rounded up and imprisoned, and at least 10 Palestinians have been killed, including several children, a pregnant mother, and a 17-year-old boy whose burnt, mutilated body was found dumped in a forest outside East Jerusalem. These actions expose the terrorism of a racist settler colonial state. IJAN stands in solidarity with the Palestinian people and defends their right, the Palestinians' right, to resist the violence of colonialism and apartheid. IJAN mourns the loss of all human life. We also recognize that the deaths of these three Jewish settlers are being exploited to justify Israel's ongoing colonization of Palestinian lands and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Israel and its supporters, including Western media and politicians, have portrayed these Jewish settlers as innocent casualties, either of alleged Palestinian barbarism or Israel and its supporters, including Western media and politicians, have portrayed these Jewish settlers, the three youth, as innocent casualties either of alleged Palestinian barbarism or of an intractably and inexplicably tragic conflict. In either case, Jewish Israeli lives are recognized and valued, while Palestinian lives are invisible and meaningless. Also erased is these settlers' presence on the front lines of the Zionists' terrorizing and dispossession of Palestine's indigenous population. Further blotted out is the constant terrorism of the Zionist project and its irreducible responsibility for all deaths which occur in the course of its brutal expansion, be they Israeli or Palestinian. IJAN also insists that any people whose lands, livelihood, and dignity are being robbed from them by colonizers have a right to resist this violence. Prominent Zionist thinkers have often cynically recognized this fact. As the political predecessor of the present-day Israeli right, Vladimir Jabotinsky famously wrote, quote, "Every people will struggle against colonizers as long as there is a spark of hope in ridding itself of the danger of colonization. This, too, is what the Palestinian Arabs are doing and will go on doing as long as there is a spark of hope," end quote. The brutality Israel is currently carrying out with the diplomatic and financial support of the U.S. state is a futile attempt to extinguish that spark of hope and to once again knowingly mislabel popular resistance against oppression as, quote, terrorism. IJAN stands in solidarity with and honors the perseverance of Palestinian resistance and calls on civil society everywhere to hold Israel accountable for its recurrent crimes and end the occupation, colonization, and apartheid in Palestine. We also call on Jewish people everywhere to recognize in this most recent bout of Israeli terror, a larger and unmistakable pattern of unbridled violence and murder, collective punishment and hatred. We reject the suggestion that this is in the name of, quote, the Jewish people. Propelled by the inescapable implications of its colonial logic, Zionism is not a revival of Jewish communal life, but a self-fulfilling prophecy of self-destruction. As Jewish people, we must act for the sake of Palestinian self-determination. And in bold-faced letters, it ends, "It is urgent that we act. Over the next week, please organize rallies, protests, actions, demonstrations, and vigils to protest this latest escalation of Israeli violence." The International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, in solidarity with the Palestinians and their expressions and actions of resistance. A few notes here on the particulars of this article, of this statement, to condemn Israel's escalation of violence by IJAN. It is indeed an ongoing debacle which is generated by a clearly repressive military regime, effectively the military regime of a self-garrisoned society, which constantly and unceasingly claims to have the right to protect itself from what it sees as a kind of natural situation in that part of the world, with the suggestion that the Arabs will always hate the Jews, that the Arabs are only seeking the destruction of the Jews. Certainly you hear that from Arab quarters once in a while among the most severely right-wing, hateful Arabs, although many of those voices of the Arab right come from personal experience. They may be Palestinian, they may know Palestinians who have suffered and been killed at the hands of Israelis and Arabs of surrounding nations such as Jordan, Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon, who have had family members in the army who were killed in battle. So, you know, it kind of flares out from there. The bad tidings and the unforgettable instances, whether or not the people were able to forgive the killers, the perpetrators of violence and expansionism, etc. Forgive the past, but can't forget. Or perhaps not even forgive. I appreciate this IGN's, this one paragraph here, the one that I had a lot of problem pronouncing. IGN mourns the loss of all human life. We also recognize that the deaths of these three Jewish settlers are being exploited, for example, in the Israeli media, to justify Israel's ongoing colonization of Palestinian lands and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Israel and its supporters, including Western media and politicians, have portrayed these Jewish settlers as innocent casualties, either of alleged Palestinian barbarism or of an intractably and inexplicably tragic conflict. In either case, Jewish Israeli lives are recognized and valued, while Palestinian lives are invisible and meaningless. That one sentence alone. Jewish Israeli lives are recognized and valued, while Palestinian lives are invisible and meaningless, pretty much says the bulk of my position on the activities coming out of the what's supposed to be the Holy Land ever since the kidnapping and subsequent discovery of the bodies of the three Israeli youths. That says it all for me. Not to mention all the statistics that I read in the previous article from Mazin Kumsiye's weblog. Hundreds, 10 Palestinians killed since then, 500 detained under military administrative detention, no charges, no nothing. That's par for the course for the Palestinian people. That is a matter of long-standing, decades-long history, certainly since 1967 when Israel launched its surprise attack against Egypt and fought Jordan and Syria and gained even more land, basically the remainder of historic Palestine, plus the entire Egyptian Sinai Peninsula and a piece of land extending ever so close to Syria's capital of Damascus, all taken from them, still held on to this day, except of course the Sinai. The Gaza Strip, even though it no longer has any Jewish settlers in it, is still under what is, in effect, a continuing occupation. Occupation by a foreign power as defined by the United Nations because of Israel's control of its land, sea, and air access points, Gaza's international, so-called international airport, was bombed many years ago, and even if, you know, it's the craters are still there, the ruin is still there, even if it was rebuilt up to being a standard state-of-the-art airport again, it still would be useless as the Israel forbids international flights from coming in or leaving. The only planes you'll see over any part of the Gaza Strip are, of course, Israeli warplanes who drop bombs and strafe the population with bullets. The Gaza Strip is effectively under occupation, technically, legally, by international terms, because the people there constitute what is very often referred to as the world's largest open-air prison. 1.7 or 1.8 million Palestinians in a stretch of land no more than 35 miles long and just a few miles wide. Israel deliberately, and this is well documented, deliberately restricts the flow of goods, services, repair material, medicine, educational materials for the children and for university students there. Apparently, purely out of spite and a desire to turn the screws on Palestinian society in the Gaza Strip. Israel may say this is, they do this because Hamas, the controlling political government of Gaza, is, as they would say, a terrorist organization, and they have to do something about that. It only makes the situation worse for the native Palestinians, and so they become more resentful and they fire more rockets and mortars and missiles into Israel. This is what is truly horrid about Israeli policy in Gaza, is that they know full well that if they lighten up this turning of the screws against the Palestinians there, that there's more of a chance that the splinter groups and ultra-militants of the Gaza Strip will cease the firing of their weapons upon Israel, which incidentally have killed a minuscule number of Israeli Jews over the past 10 or 15 years. Since the year 2000, I think it's been no more than 20 Israelis have been killed, where several thousands of Palestinian citizens have died at the hands of the Israelis in bombings and tank and army incursions into the Gaza Strip, several of them, far more than most people are aware of. Thousands of Palestinian lives lost, and many, many, many more times that, injured and homeless, made homeless, even in this open-air prison. Getting back to IJAN's statement here. It makes reference, IJAN makes reference to prominent Zionist thinkers. And mentions Vladimir Jabotinsky, who I believe is a Russian Jew, who worked towards and fought for a Zionist state in Palestine. He died in 1940. Jabotinsky did. And he wrote something called The Iron Wall, an article entitled The Iron Wall in the 1920s, and its most famous publication, I believe, is in 38, shortly before his death, a couple of years before his death. And I read the article in its English translation, and quite frankly, it mystified me. I mean, I couldn't even see the logic of this man's way of thinking. But IJAN gives the Jabotinsky quote here, famous quote here, Every people will struggle against colonizers as long as there is a spark of hope of ridding itself of the danger of colonization. This, too, is what the Palestinian Arabs are doing and will go on doing as long as there is a spark of hope. Ostensibly, initially, to begin with, you look at a statement like that and you tend to see that as sympathy for the Palestinians who were occupied, being colonized, and being oppressed by an outside force. You'd think that, but having read the article, I know that what Jabotinsky is doing in his bizarre way of thinking is to warn people that while it's true that anybody under colonization and the threat of occupation will, understandably, as Jabotinsky puts it, fight this oppression off, instead of actually being in sympathy, this is Jabotinsky's way of warning his fellow Jewish Zionists that this is why we have to get rid of the Palestinians, so they won't be there to take these actions to prevent themselves. This is the crazy man Jabotinsky and his crazy way of thinking. I'll reread the one of the last couple of paragraphs here. The International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, IJN, stands in solidarity with and honors the perseverance of Palestinian resistance and calls on civil society everywhere to hold Israel accountable for its recurrent crimes and end the occupation, colonization, and apartheid in Palestine. We also call on Jewish people everywhere to recognize in this most recent bout of Israeli terror a larger and unmistakable pattern of unbridled violence and murder, collective punishment, and hatred. We reject the suggestion that this is in the name of, quote, the Jewish people, end quote. There are indeed millions, literally millions of Jews in the United States, around the world, and more and more and more within Israel itself, Jews in Israel, who are beginning to recognize and to reject the futility and the folly of Zionism, that it has only caused the deaths and, in some cases, the misery, the ongoing suffering of many Jewish people, unless, of course, they can tighten their security wall and their oppression of the native Palestinian Arabs so much that they can begin to forget about them and just sit back in their garrison state of Israel and try to live a normal life. Is that any way for any country to have to live? They brought it on themselves. If they want to stay in Israel, fine. In their hearts, Israel, Palestine, will continue to be the Israel, the land of the Hebrew people, as it was a couple of thousand years ago, but that there is absolutely no need to sweep the native Arabs away and pretend that this is the only way that the Jewish people can live in a truly secure and unblemished environment. Okay. My friends, it's 4:05 p.m. this Monday, July 7th, 2014. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live always, at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the free streaming link. Short break. I'll be right back.
Artistic types are so misunderstood. While everyone's a critic, they don't know when something's good. Just let us have our space and freedom to create. And when the work is finished, we'll tell you if it's great. My painter friend is Stefan. I'm screwing his wife Mia. Well, no, it doesn't bother him. In fact, it's his idea. You common people try to pass it off as sick behavior, but it's how he gets inspired. I'm doing him a favor. Artists wanna share their gift. It's often that they can't. Thank God that Stefan finally got that NEA grant. Stefan's exhibition is a masterpiece to see. It's a series done in oil of his wife in bed with me. Really wild positions all throughout his home. We cluttered every room with empty tubes of paint and foam. multiplied by Marquis de Sade. When he discovered porno, he was instantly consumed. Then he fell in love with Mia, and his heart began to bloom. Congress tried to pull his funding, as his approach is raw. Well, technically, in many states, it is against the law. Know the one of Mia with the gerbil in her hand. It's called the veterinary and it goes for 30 grand. Find that is something but the cultural elite line up to throw their platitudes and money at his feet. Stefan's exhibition is a masterpiece to see. A series done in oil of his wife in bed with me. In really wild positions all throughout his home. We cluttered every room with empty tubes of paint. He's done good work before, but this is closer to his heart. I'm glad that I can help out my friend Stefan with his art. And all the sex and violence is a brilliant metaphor. I'm not really raping Mia on the living room floor. Tonight is quite momentous. Is a masterpiece to see. A series done in oil of his wife in bed with me. In really wild positions all throughout his home. We cluttered every room with empty tubes of paint and foam. He's done good work before, but this is closer to his heart. I'm glad that I can help out my friend Stefan with his art.
Standard deviations from me.
two songs that, in my opinion, deserve much more laudits and exposure than they probably ever got back in the 90s, the early 90s. The first one, Stefan's Exhibition, from Stuart Davis's fourth album, by the way, entitled Nomen est Numen. To name is to know in Latin. And the second one, the one you just heard, Noah's New Ark. Did you all catch the inference to Zionist exclusivism in the way that they think of themselves? That kind of extreme, supposedly Judaistic thought? No, I'm not an anti-Semite. Well, I'm not an anti-Semite, though. I'm talking about extremists, which you have in any society and even in any religion, who simply go too far and who end up exercising the worst form of hypocrisy and treachery, ultimately, against someone else. Any religion can do that. Any nationality can commit those crimes. That doesn't mean I'm necessarily anti-Catholic or anti-Protestant, anti-Buddhist, anti-Chinese, anti-Rwandan, French, English, anyone else you can come up with. All right. The rest of the show is pretty much going to be taken up by either your phone calls to area code 831-427-3772. That's 427-3772. And we shall discuss and confer. And everyone will hear us. You just got to call in. And not be afraid about interrupting the rest of the program, which pretty much will be taken up by a couple of recordings I have. I hope we can get through the second one. This is Gaza is Burning, passed along to me by fellow free radio programmer Donna Wallach. Gaza is Burning. Here's what the corporate media isn't telling you. Let's see. Featuring journalist Abby Martin. Martin reports on the latest violence in Israel and speaks with author and journalist Max Blumenthal. Max Blumenthal, interviewed on RT by Abby Martin. This is available on YouTube. Let's hear it, folks.
Tensions in Israel are heightened following the discovery of the bodies of three Israeli teens who had been missing for weeks. According to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Palestinian group Hamas is responsible and as such has ordered airstrikes across the Gaza Strip. And to make matters worse, just today, the body of a Palestinian teen was discovered in what his family claims to be a revenge killing by three men who forced him into a car and drove away. So to discuss these recent events, as well as the side of the story you won't hear from the corporate press, I'm joined now by journalist and author of Goliath, Fear and Loathing in Greater Israel, Max Blumenthal. Amazing to have you on, Max.
Great to be on with you.
So, Max, start by briefly giving us the most recent updates. What are you hearing happening on the ground during the last 24 hours?
There are clashes in Shufat, where the 17-year-old Palestinian boy who was found murdered, apparently in an Jewish extremist revenge attack, was from. It's a refugee camp in occupied East Jerusalem, and these clashes have been going on for a day. This is following Israel rampaging through the West Bank, abducting over 500 Palestinians, placing almost 200 under administrative detention without charges, raiding universities, killing six people while bombing the Gaza Strip, and exacting casualties there. And it's my view that the Israeli government knew from the beginning that the three kidnapped and murdered Israeli teens were dead. They knew who the alleged perpetrators were, who the chief suspects were, and they may have even had an idea of where the bodies were from the beginning 2 weeks ago, and that they concealed this information through a gag order from the Israeli public in order to bring us to the crisis where we are today, which has only benefited Netanyahu and his extremely right-wing coalition at the expense of everyone else living under their control.
Right. According to Mondo Weiss, the Israeli government allegedly did know about those circumstances, Max, put a gag order on the case. Really unfortunate. Why do you think that there is that clampdown on information just to get those tensions heightened?
To unite the Israeli public against Palestinians and behind Netanyahu has carefully staged managed this crisis by, for instance, deploying his wife to introduce the Bring Back Our Boys hashtag. Mm-hmm. Netanyahu appeared on Israeli media constantly looking at maps. Netanyahu's statement after the three kidnapped teens were allegedly found, although they may have been, their bodies may have been discovered earlier, invoked a poem by the famous Jewish poet Chaim Bialik referring to a Jewish massacre in Europe and calling for blood vengeance. So he's explicitly linking this to the Holocaust. He referred to the killers and Hamas as human animals, and his incitement has led directly to the murder of this 17-year-old Palestinian boy apparently abducted by settlers. Now, the Israeli government and its intelligence services and the Palestinian Authority had a recording of a phone call by one of the Israeli teens who were apparently abducted, that and they could hear a gunshot in the phone call. They had known that these teens were dead since sometime around July 14th. Not only that, but it was reported in Palestinian media that the Israeli forces had raided the homes of the Kawasme and Abu Aisha families in Hebron, 10 kilometers from the site of the alleged kidnapping, and accused these their sons of conducting the kidnapping. Those are the two suspects who've been announced, but they were announced 2 weeks later. So it's clear to me that the Israeli government has manipulated this situation to avoid a police action, to justify a military action directed at Hamas and the Palestinian Unity Government, which has led to the crisis we're seeing today.
And Max, and then you have the housing minister calling for more settlements as a retaliatory measure. I mean, there's a ton of inflammatory rhetoric. There's a lot of tensions heightened right now. Let's take a look at the media coverage in the aftermath. The front page of the New York Times today showed a Palestinian throwing a rock in relation to the story about the Palestinian being murdered. Max, what does this type of framing reveal about the media bias regarding this entire situation?
Well, Jody Rudorin, who's the chief correspondent for the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau, a bureau that is housed in the home of the Karmi family, a Palestinian family who have been ethnically cleansed and who have to ask the New York Times reporters for permission to see their house in West Jerusalem. Jody Rudorin has produced, along with her deputy editor, Isabel Kirshner, articles profiling the three killed Israeli teens, humanizing them, deeply empathetic articles about their mothers. There's been very little on the Palestinians who've been killed in Israel's rampage through the West Bank and Gaza Strip, or the Palestinians who've been killed in apparent racist hate crimes, in revenge attacks incited by Netanyahu. Worse is the article today by Rudorin and Kirshner, which waits till the 18th paragraph to discuss the campaign of incitement and the race riots in Jerusalem by Jewish extremists who have been stoked by high-level figures in the Israeli governing coalition. It's clear that the New York Times is engaged in a whitewash of the real sources of this crisis and doing deep disservice to its readers. Beyond that, Abby, I see very little discussion of this crisis and the real roots of it in progressive media.
Right.
And your show is one of the few shows that I see discussing it, even in the alternative online media.
And let's get into that, Max, because according to the Ministry of Information in Ramallah, so many Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces since the Second Intifada that it equates to one being killed every 3 days for the last 13 years. And in fact, two Palestinian teens were just gunned down broad daylight on camera last month. I didn't hear the White House issuing condolences for them. Why do you think this latest tragedy is being framed as different, even by alternative media sources, suggesting that because Israeli teens are dead, it somehow makes the playing field equal?
We're hearing a lot of rhetoric about a cycle of violence, as if one side isn't the oppressor and the other side isn't oppressed. And we're seeing undue focus on the Israeli the three Israeli victims. Israel, while it rampages through the West Bank, through Jerusalem and Gaza, portrays itself as the victim. And that was Netanyahu's intention from the beginning. That's partly why I think the details of this crime were concealed from the Israeli public. It was to allow Netanyahu to milk this crime for all it was worth, to portray Israel as a victim. And as we've seen time and time again in U.S. media, Israeli Jews are the worthy victims, while Palestinians are unworthy victims. They're unworthy of being humanized. And Jody Rudorin of the New York Times, who recently wrote about one of the boys killed in broad daylight, who you mentioned, on closed caption TV, execution style by an Israeli soldier, referred to him as one among the thousands who died in the struggle against Israel. That is the kind of language that's consistent with the dehumanization of Palestinians in supposedly objective media.
And Max, I'm curious of what your response is to people who say, well, what do you expect Israel to do when rockets are being shot into the country, and what retaliation should be issued for the kidnapping and murder of its citizens?
I expect Israel to decolonize and allow the 80% of the people from the Gaza Strip who are refugees to be allowed to return to their land and property that was taken from them. If you want to understand the roots of Palestinian violent resistance, you can't go back 1 week or 2 weeks or a few years ago or a few intifadas ago. This is not a cycle of violence. It's rooted in a settler colonial apartheid state, which is engaged in an ongoing campaign to dispossess Palestinians of all they have in order to consolidate its ethnic purity. That's the root of this crisis, and that's what we should be talking about, as well as the current round of violence. And this will continue as long as the status quo continues. All of the trends that we're seeing today, including the fascist trends in Israeli society, will deepen and intensify.
Lastly, Max, we have about a minute left, but I wanted to talk about boycott, divestment, sanctions. Noam Chomsky just wrote this article in The Nation saying Palestinian activists need to rethink their strategy. But in it, and I can't read the whole quote because we don't have time, but he basically says that if the road goes ahead in the same route that it is now, it's going to be worse than South Africa. Why do you think that he doesn't support BDS, but still seems to understand the severity of the situation on the ground, that it could be worse than South Africa?
Well, I have a lot of respect for Noam Chomsky. I don't really want to trash him personally, but I've noticed from a lot of critics of BDS who claim to criticize it as allies of Palestinians that they're laundering their own opinions behind a very conservative and even cynical view of reality to limit the horizons that BDS has expanded, the political horizons. And that's what Chomsky appears to be doing. He's almost asking us to accept the status quo that Israel's imposed and to limit the Palestinian demands in BDS, which is, I think, already demonstrating a lot of great successes. So I think it's really up to those of us who consider us allies of Palestinians, who are in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for justice, to allow Palestinian civil society to continue to take the lead and to not try to impose our own conditions and our own limitations on their struggle. It's unfortunate that
the nation has chosen
to publish this.
Thank you so much, Max Blumenthal. Always incredible insight on this crisis. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now I want to step back here and find a film that I was looking at last night. It is some 42 to 45 minutes long. I believe it is entitled The Great Challenge, Israel. Of course, this being radio, you will only hear the soundtrack, and I will provide English translations provided here in English subtitles for the French, Italian, and other foreign interviewees. Using stock footage of American religious fundamentalists and political interviews against original interview footage with experts on international relations, The Great Challenge Israel documents the role of the Israeli lobbies and their relationship with the U.S. Congress. The film provides backgrounds on relations between, etc., etc. Because of the limited time left, only some 32 minutes. Oh, God, barely a half hour. Well, I still want to play this, so I'm going to cut through the rather dramatic and insightful footage of the Christian fundamentalists as they justify what Israel does, supposedly in the name of religious prophecy. And what's going on now? Let's try that again. Oh boy. Okay. Here we go.
Now tonight, I want you to turn with me to the 24th chapter of Matthew's Gospel.
Skip way ahead.
The 15 million in the 15 million in the whole world.
Côté économie, en fait, sont
the great challenge, Israel. From Press TV. Translation, I've studied the diary of an American consul which went back to the 1850s. Even at that time, they were talking about Christian Zionism. They believed that Jerusalem was the shared cultural inheritance of both Christians and Jews.
Sia cristiana
Jerusalem
che
was.
Giudaica.
La seule occasion pour les protestants, la seule,
the Orthodox and Catholics both have their own place in Jerusalem, but the Protestants don't, says this gentleman, French guy.
Les chrétiens appellent la Terre Sainte. On trouve les orthodoxes, les catholiques.
If American economists pay too much attention to the issue of oil, ideologically speaking,
si les économistes, les dirigeants plutôt des
the Protestants will support the Jews. En fait, that is because the Bible says the snake will eat its own tail.
Les protestants appuient le mouvement sioniste par conviction religieuse tout le temps à ce rappel de la Bible.
The Protestants will
le serpent mordra
sa queue. Picture of ancient Hebrew writing here.
Snake
will eat its own tail, meaning that the Israeli nation will return to its country.
Sacré d'un texte.
Picture of, I believe, the Second Temple of ancient times.
Protestantism is one of the three main sects of Christianity. Martin Luther was the person who wrote its principles. The word Protestant means objector or dissenter. The followers of this religious order were called Protestant because they opposed some of the rules of the Catholic Church. Martin Luther read the Old Testament and compared the Gospel to the Torah. Then he introduced some great innovations to Catholicism, saying that God had chosen the Jews was one of them. This belief did not last long, and he turned against the Jews and Judaism at the end of his life. One of his statements is worth thinking about. Jews carry the noblest blood in their veins. It was through them that the Holy Spirit promoted the Bible all over the world. They, the Jews, are children of God. Compared to them, we are strangers. As shown in the story of the Canaanite woman, we are like dogs eating the breadcrumbs of our masters. Preaching the Christian gospel, whose followers call it evangelism, is a branch of Protestantism. It was established in the 1730s in Britain. The evangelist's motto is returning to the gospel and changing the society. They wish to build a government in the US based on the gospel and the return of Christ. The evangelists believe that the only way to realize that is by supporting the Jews and establishing the Great Israel at the time of Armageddon.
D'après la Bible, le peuple juif doit retourner,
for the doomsday to come, the Jews need to return to their land first,
a religious issue.
This is François Marshall, political expert,
talking.
They rely on religious books to justify their own atrocities and bloodshed in Palestine.
L'enfermement de population dans des camps comme Gaza, par exemple.
Regarding what I mentioned about the American consul in 1850 and Jerusalem in the 19th century, the 1800s, there's something else, too. This was mentioned by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt in their famous book about the Zionist lobby in the United States. This is Claudio Moffa, professor of history and international relations, speaking. Their explanation is that the country's Zionist lobby has an increasing desire to guide the U.S. policies towards the Middle East. Their ultimate goal is to protect Israel.
As if the American Jewish lobby had influence on American policy.
Here's TV journalist Charlie Rose interviewing Zbigniew Brzezinski.
So not good for America or good for Israel?
For America, it's not very good at all, I think.
And they've had that amount of power, in your judgment?
I think they have a considerable amount of power. Look at how legislation is passed limiting freedom of action of the United States.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, former national security advisor.
They're just efficient. It's a small amount, and they're efficient. AIPAC is American-Israeli Public Alliance Committee. It makes a convention once a year in Washington, in the largest convention hall, and almost every single politician, Democrat, Republican, President, Majority Leader, Minority, everybody comes and bows down to, gives respect to the AIPAC. A congressman called Paul Finley wrote a book about
the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
And he was an incumbent. I think he was a
This is Yosrael David Weiss, member of Jews United Against Zionism, speaking. He is clearly an Orthodox Hasidic Jew by his manner and by what he wears.
So what the Zionists did was they simply found somebody to run against him, and they put in a tremendous amount of money into the other guy's campaign. Now, what happens is, that's not such a big thing. It's only one congressman. But everybody takes an example from that. All the other congressmen says, listen, what am I, nuts?
E Kennedy probabilmente il punto di svolta.
Then we came to Kennedy. Kennedy probably set a turning point. Because after him, all the other U.S. presidents were basically under Israel's thumb. Kennedy sometimes showed anti-Israel sentiment. He was the person who talked to Abdel Nasser, who was one of Israel's greatest enemies, the late president of Egypt. Nasser had a revolutionary stance towards Palestine and believed that Palestine had to be freed through resistance.
In their book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer conclude that if the Zionist lobby succeeds in implementing its policies in the U.S., Israel's enemies in the Middle East will weaken and crumble one by one. Then Israel will have a free hand in dealing with the Palestinians, while the U.S. will have to take on a great part of the war expenses and damages.
Another sin that the Zionist lobby believed Kennedy had committed, besides his talk with Nasser, was a letter dated in 1963 that he wrote to the Israeli Prime Minister Levi Eshkol 3 or 4 months before his assassination in Dallas. In the letter, he asked them to allow the U.S. to inspect the Dimona nuclear site in Israel. As I said, 3 or 4 months after that request, Kennedy was assassinated. A new person being interviewed here, Juliette Scanrani, a political activist. And it should not be forgotten that Israel is the only... There are 400 nuclear warheads in the Dimona Research Center in the Negev Desert. These bombs have taken the whole region hostage, she says. As someone who's opposed to nuclear bombs, I always said that if Israel has nuclear bombs, Iran should too. Then we could be sure that neither of them will use it. The old mutual assured destruction philosophy. We should either destroy Israel's weapons or allow Iran to have weapons of its own.
I don't think so. I think they're going to go to war with Iran because it's really not an American choice anymore. It's an Israeli choice.
Michael Schur, former CIA intelligence officer, speaking.
You'll notice when Obama wanted to talk about whether there should be war against the Iranians, he didn't go to the Congress, he didn't go to the American people, he went to AIPAC and more or less pled for more time to make sanctions work.
So how do you separate rhetoric, though, from reality? Because I've seen at APEC, Iran has been the top of their agenda for as long as I've been covering it. And clearly, there's plenty of documentation that APEC is, you know, arguably the strongest foreign policy lobby in the United States. But how do we know that that will lead to some kind of attack and what that would look like?
Well, they're not only the most strongest, they're the most corrupting. They've corrupted the American political system, both in the Congress and on the campaign trail. Otherwise, who would pay attention to them if it wasn't for money?
Well, can you give us some examples that you feel substantiate that?
Look at Senator Lieberman. Senator Lieberman is the voice of Israel in the Congress.
Again, this man, Michael Shuler, is a former CIA analyst.
He is champions IPAC and the rest of those organizations.
Do not let anyone tell you that a nuclear-armed Iran is just Israel's problem. It is not.
Do you think that the American people really want to go to war to protect the Israelis' interests? I don't think so. We intervened in Libya. We intervened in Iraq. We're going to follow the Israeli lead and intervene into Iran. And the bottom line is none of those countries pose a threat to the United States in even the remotely distant future. And we are going to further destroy our own economy for the interests of the Israelis, their lobby, and the people they control in both American political parties.
Per esempio, l'episodio che viene raccontato da Gore Vidal e che a Gore Vidal sarebbe stato riferito da John Kennedy.
After Roosevelt's death at the time of the U.S. presidential elections campaign, Harry Truman was in charge of the U.S. presidency. At that time, one of the representatives of a U.S. Jewish community met Truman. He was carrying a case containing $2 million. He told Truman that if he recognizes Israel as a state, he'd win the election. That incident happened before Israel declared itself a state, because we're talking about 1947 or 1948.
The extent of the Zionist lobby's influence on U.S. foreign policies has increased considerably. It started before the establishment of Israel.
What if the Prime Minister of Israel called you on the phone and said, our bombers are on
Bob
the way.
Bob Schieffer, I believe, speaking.
We're going to bomb Iran. What do you
Bob, let's not go into hypotheticals of that nature. Our relationship with Israel, my relationship with the Prime Minister of Israel is such that we would not get a call saying our bombers are on the way.
When I've sent young men and women into harm's way,
Barack
I always
Obama.
Understand that that is the last resort, not the first resort.
Of course, a military action is the last resort.
And it should not be forgotten that the U.S. has spent more than half of its budget on wars that mostly happened under the Democrats' tenure. As many experts say, many of these wars are not America's wars.
And Israel itself as a country is not the problem. The real problem is the leaders of the Jewish American community in the United States who influence and corrupt our Congress to support Israel when we have no interest there.
So let me ask you this. Who would want to create the impression that we need to engage in military activity, which a lot of the neocons demanded before the ink was even dry on this criminal complaint against Iran?
Oh, the only people that would benefit from that would be the Israelis and the Saudis. And I think if I was looking at a counterintelligence operation to decide where this information came from, I'd be very interested to see if I could find an Israeli hand or a Saudi hand. Because in the long run, Judge, both Israel and Saudi Arabia are much more dangerous enemies to the United States than the Iranians are.
You imply that the Israeli lobby is dragging the United States into the wars, into
Absolutely.
The conflict?
They're absolutely dragging us in. Iraq was a war that was proffered or was called for.
Interview 2011, in an interview with
Arizona
Financial
Senator
Times,
Michael Caine,
he said, I disagreed with the President Obama.
John McCain, former
his
presidential
decision to
candidate
surge in Iraq,
for the
because
Republican
I did
John
with
McCain.
President Bush on the surge in Iraq. Do you stand by that?
Interrogating
those comments, Senator Hagel?
in committee here, Senator Chuck Hagel, former Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, now our current Secretary of Defense.
Well, I would defer to the judgment of history to sort that out. But
the committee deserves your judgment as to whether you were right or wrong about the surge.
I'll explain why I made those comments. And
I want to know if you were right or wrong. That's a direct question. I expect a direct answer.
The surge assisted in the objective, but if we review the record a little bit...
Will you please answer the question? Were you correct or incorrect when you said that the surge would be the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam? Were you correct or incorrect? Yes or no?
My reference to the surge being the most dangerous...
Senator Hagel, the question is, were you right or wrong? That's a pretty straightforward question.
Well,
I would like to answer whether you were right or wrong, and then you are free to elaborate.
Well, I'm not going to give you a yes or no answer
on
a lot of things.
Well, let the show that you refused to answer that question. Now, please go ahead.
One fundamental question that I asked myself on every vote I took, every decision I made, was the policy worthy of the men and women that we were sending into battle and surely to their deaths?
Una guerra preceduta da una grande menzogna mediatica.
A war that starts with a big lie by Western media. Blah, blah. The existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, weapons that did not exist. A U.S. congressman called Jim Moran rejected this lie in early March. He told Bush, "Hey Bush, what are you doing? You're not working in the interest of the U.S., you're working in the interests of Israel."
In a magazine interview, Congressman Jim Moran of Virginia hits the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. AIPAC is the most powerful lobby and has pushed this war from the beginning. I don't think they represent the mainstream of American Jewish thinking at all, but because they are so well organized, they have been able to exert power.
Immediatamente,
this courageous congressman was immediately attacked. Everyone accused him of being an anti-Semitist and racist. He was forced to apologize in the end.
We're not allowed to be highly critical.
Scott Ritter speaking here.
And the other thing we're not allowed to do is discuss the notion that Israel and the notion of Israeli interests may in fact be dictating what America is doing. That what we're doing in the Middle East may not be to the benefit of America's national security, but to Israel's national security. But see, we don't want to talk about that because one of the great success stories out there is the pro-Israeli lobby that has successfully enabled themselves to blend the two together so that when we speak of Israeli interests, they say, no, we're speaking of American interests. It's interesting that AIPAC and other elements of the Israeli lobby don't have to register as agents of a foreign government.
Let's get the proportions straight, okay? AIPAC is a powerful lobby. It has a lot of money. It has wealthy contributors, right? We're talking about the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, I think it is. It does a lot of advocacy work for Israel. It wants foreign aid for Israel, military aid for Israel. It pursues other goals that are valuable for the Israelis. But you have to understand, AIPAC acts on Congress. It can be decisive in the House of Representatives, less so for the Senate, and still less so for the presidency. But even here, we're talking about the elected, legal, visible government. It's fine to have a lot of power over the Congress. You can get, you know, large sums of money. But the power of the U.S. Congress is limited. In some ways, the U.S. Congress is a joke. It's not a very powerful branch of government. So if AIPAC, even if they dominate Congress, which they can't always do, if they dominate the Congress, we always have to remember that the locus of real power is very often this other entity, right? The interface of Wall Street with the Pentagon, the CIA, and the State Department. This is where power is found. No, the secret government, the invisible government, the parallel government. Remember, the United States is ruled by finance. It is not ruled by industrial interests or even the military-industrial complex.
AIPAC is definitely a part of that. The AIPAC as a lobby for Israel.
Colin Cowell, Center for American
Israel
Studies in Bahrain.
Very closely with the United States government. Israel is seen as the American bulldog in the Middle East to effectuate American policy in the region. So AIPAC as the lobbying arm in Congress for the secular Zionists, is it the case of the tail wagging the dog, or is it the dog wagging the tail?
The political reality is that you
voice of Chuck Hagel.
Not you, but the Jewish lobby intimidates a lot of people in there. And again, I've always argued against some of the dumb things they do because I don't think it's in the interest of Israel. I just don't think it's smart for Israel. Now, everyone has a right to lobby, as it should be, and come see your senator and congressman. You can get the guy to sign your letter. Great, wonderful. But as I reminded somebody not too long ago, in fact, it was a group I was speaking to in New York, and we got into a kind of an interesting give and take on Iran. And a couple of these guys said, well, we should just attack Iran. I said, well, it's an interesting problem. We're doing so well in Iraq.
Right.
And I said, it would really help Israel. And I said, so this guy kept pushing and pushing. And he alluded to the fact that, well, maybe I wasn't supporting Israel enough or something, and I don't know how we get. And I just said, well, let me clear something up here if there's any doubt in your mind. I said, I'm a United States senator, not an Israeli senator. I'm a United States senator.
That, again, was Chuck Hagel with his famous line, I am a United States senator. I am not an Israeli senator. I am a United States senator.
We're sitting down with Michael Scheuer, the man who had served in the CIA for more than 20 years up until 2004. At one time, he was the chief of the CIA Bin Laden unit. Then he went and exposed how counter-effective Washington's methods were in the fight against terror. He looked at the U.S. through its enemy's eyes. In fact, it's the title of one of his books called Through Our Enemy's Eyes. I'm very pleased to have the chance to interview you,
Thank
Mr.
you.
Scheuer.
I'm glad to be here.
Michael Scheuer.
The U.S. pulls out of everywhere.
Yes.
Is it going to be the end of terrorism?
It certainly would deny the terrorists the glue of unity that keeps them focused on the United States. If we weren't the main enemy, they would be attacking Israel, they would be attacking the Saudis, they would be attacking the Moroccans. The war would be...
And would you say let them attack
let them go.
The Israelis and the Saudis?
Let them go. Sometimes they say the Chinese will come in. I said, let the Chinese deal with these people for the next 50 years. We've had enough of it.
Stop confusing the American public that Israel's interests are necessarily America's interests. I have to tell you right now, Israel has a viable, valid concern about Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. If I were an Israeli, I'd be extremely concerned about Hezbollah, and I would want to do everything possible to nullify that organization. As an American, I will tell you, Hezbollah does not threaten the national security of the United States of America one iota. So we should not be talking about using American military forces to deal with the Hezbollah issue. That is an Israeli problem, and yet you'll see the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other media outlets confusing the issue. They want us to believe that Hezbollah is an American problem. It isn't, ladies and gentlemen. Hezbollah was created 3 years after Israel invaded Lebanon, not 3 years after the United States invaded Lebanon, and Hezbollah's sole purpose was to liberate southern Lebanon from Israeli occupation. I'm not here to condone or sing high praises and virtue for Hezbollah, but I'm here to tell you right now, Hezbollah is not a terrorist organization that threatens the security of the United States of America.
The Israeli lobby has always tried to suggest that the U.S. and Israel are always on the same page, but the difference and divergences in their interests have sometimes led to warnings and oppositions from U.S. presidents. For example, tensions between the U.S. president and the Israeli prime minister over their differences on the Iranian nuclear issue and military attack increased considerably after a while. So much so that when Netanyahu visited the U.S. in September 2012, Obama refused to meet him.
We
begin with a very public and new escalation of some tension between President Obama and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Israeli sources tell me the White House, at least for now, has rejected Prime Minister Netanyahu's request to meet with President Obama later this month to discuss Iran's nuclear program. Those same sources tell me the Israelis were told a meeting isn't possible because of the president's schedule. Schedule, they say, won't permit it, even when the Israelis offered to have the prime minister come to Washington from New York, where he'll be addressing the United Nations.
Siccome Netanyahu.
You should know that Netanyahu hates Obama, says Julieta Chiesa, a journalist author. He considers him the enemy and prefers...
They issued a statement. They were pretty upset about this inability, apparently, for Netanyahu and the president to get together. Let me put it
Wolf
up on the screen.
Blitzer interviewing someone
it, to you. It is puzzling that the president can't make time to see the head of state of one of America's closest allies in the world. If these reports are true, the two senators go on to say, the White House's decision sends a troubling signal to our ally Israel about America's commitment at this dangerous and challenging time. You were at a meeting recently. The Israeli Prime Minister was there. The U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, was there. This is a U.S.-Israeli strategic cooperation meeting. And apparently there were some angry words exchanged. Just set the record straight for us. What happened there?
Well, I can tell you that I walked out of the meeting with the understanding that the Israeli government is a little frustrated with the lack of certainty
Representative
on
Mike Rogers.
On behalf of the United States.
Quindi io così interpreto la situazione.
Israele My evaluation of the situation is that Israel has always been used as a tool for separating the Arabs. And it's been successful. Israel has been useful in scaring the Arabs as well. That's why Israel is obviously an ally of Saudi Arabia, even though it may seem contradictory. The Saudis are Muslims. Not Jews, but Israel and Saudi Arabia have always worked together in a systematic way. Don't tell me Saudi Arabia is a democracy. That will make me laugh. And don't tell me that Qatar is a democracy as well. Look at Qatar. This is what democracy means to them. Picture it here of someone having their head cut off. Recognizing Israel, they don't care that they're dealing with a dictatorship. What matters to them is having good economic relations with Israel. We have freedom of speech in the West, but not where Israel is concerned. No freedom of speech regarding Israel is tolerated. Do you know what happened to me last month, says this interviewee? Last month I talked about Palestine's complete freedom. This is an activist here, French activist, I believe. And they sent four Betard agents to me. They came to my house wearing masks. Betard is a Jewish radical right organization. They threatened me because I spoke my mind about Israel. As I said once, their beliefs are based on a religious concept. Only the Jews are allowed to live on that land. So Israel is a government established on the basis of a particular standpoint of a particular religion. It's a racist. It's racist. Racist. It clearly differentiated between the Jews and the Palestinians. A differentiation that is undeniable. The Jews and the Palestinians are of two different religions. So they can never come to an agreement regarding Israel's worldview. End of story.
Welcome back to Hardball. We're back with the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. His new book is called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Chris Matthews interviewing Jimmy Carter.
Why did he use the word apartheid in the book's title?
But there's no doubt that within the occupied territories, Palestinian land, that there is a horrendous example of apartheid. The occupation of Palestinian land, the confiscation of that land that doesn't belong to Israel, the building of settlements on it, the colonization of that land, and then the connection of those isolated but multiple settlements, more than 200 of them, with each other by highways, on which Palestinians can't travel, and quite often where Palestinians cannot even cross. So the persecution of the Palestinians now under the occupying territories, is under the occupation forces, is one of the worst examples of human rights deprivation that I know. What is being done to the Palestinians now is horrendous in their own territory by the occupying powers, which is Israel. They've taken away all the basic human rights of the Palestinians, as was done in South Africa against the
blacks.
Unfortunately, the Zionist ideology is basically a propagator of racism. And I'm going to have to stop there, ladies and gentlemen. We're well into running up against 5 o'clock, and I was supposed to break 4 minutes ago for the program, which is due to you now. I'll talk to you again on Saturday at 11 a.m. for the book reading, They Dare to Speak Out, by Congressman Paul Finley. And, of course, you will hear from me next Monday. It'll probably be a rerun next Monday because we need to move our transmitter again, and I'm going to expect to be involved in that process. So, otherwise, 3 p.m., 3 in the afternoon on Mondays for Mideast Migraines. Thank you, and so long.